What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Wyde, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Yandra Vinaka, good morning. I'm Evan Wasuka, and this is Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. On today's show, as the United Nations General Assembly prepares to meet, Pacific activists are calling for stronger action on climate, with this reaction to Australia's new emission targets.
They announced it will be 62 to 70%, which is, a low blow for the Pacific, especially coming out of the Pacific Islands Forum.
Bougainville's electoral commissioner has stepped in to extend vote counting. We'll find out why. And Fiji romps to its third straight Pacific Nations Cup over the weekend.
One of the biggest moments in that second half was when we turned the ball over here and then Caleb kicked a good 50-22. I think that was just great from him, and I think the momentum shifted from there, and Japan just couldn't come back from that.
We'll have more on those stories coming up on Pacific Beat. World leaders are gathering in New York this week for the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Climate will be top of the agenda as countries deliver their updated emissions targets. In the Pacific, climate activists have been rallying to demand greater climate action when leaders meet at the UN. Over the weekend, more than 400 climate awareness events were staged across the world in 90 countries by activists. The ABC's Finau Fonua attended one such event in Melbourne, where dozens of Pacific environmentalists and community members braved the cold while calling for an end to global warming.
It's overcast and it's windy here at Altona Beach in Melbourne's west. And right now there's a climate action demonstration taking place on the beach. I would say there's at least 50 participants. And right now they're all holding a long row of sarongs that have been weaved together. It's an artistic statement calling for greater climate action. And it's part of a global event known as Draw the Line. A whole lot of demonstrations across the world, mostly in the form of marches. But here it's a beach event. Earlier on, I spoke to Jacinta Fa'amau. She's the campaign specialist for climate action group 350.org. That's the largest climate action group in the Pacific Islands.
Today is a global mobilization, and we're joining the global community to draw the line, and all different events. I think there's over 500 that are happening this weekend, and Melbourne is one of them. And for us, the Pacific Climate Warriors here are drawing the line at 1.5 degrees.
And this is just one of many demonstrations that are taking place today across the world. The Draw the Line movements, what prompted this?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there's been a lot of scary things happening the last couple of years. And I know that mobilizations for the climate community happen every year in September. And there's always a theme. This year, the theme was Draw the Line. So we do mobilize every September, every year. But our theme, we've made it more broad so that more people and more communities can. It doesn't have to be around climate issues. It could be around war and justice or Indigenous people. Yeah, it's kind of nice to see the turnout globally, because people can be a part of this movement and also draw the line to those in power who make a lot of decisions that influence a lot of bad things in around the world.
So right now there's a Samoan youth group performing a traditional dance. One thing you notice about this demonstration, most of the people here are young. I spoke to the coordinator of the events. Her name's Netta Mayava. She's still at uni, Why did you get involved in this movement?
Very easy question. I've been asked this many times, and it's the love for our islands. Love is definitely a big thing that drives our people. We're hardy people, and I think it's the strongest fuel that keeps us going.
The sarongs. Could you describe that? Whose idea was that? And what's the metaphor? What's the meaning behind it?
So it was actually me, but so the sarongs or lava lavas, benus, sulus, these are all things that we commonly wear. And as the motif of holding that line came to my mind, I thought, especially us for living in the diaspora, we have these materials that connect us, and we need to connect them together to be able to make this movement go forward.
Another noticeable thing about this rally is that the vast majority of participants are derived from Melbourne's Pacific Islander diaspora. I spoke to one Tongan immigrant, Mills Lomu.
I think it's really important, even though I'm here in Australia, but I have a lot of people back home in Tonga. And just to help them out and so that we can have a future. I think it's really important to stand up for the people back home, because we have a greater platform over here.
Now, one thing that's bothered a lot of climate activists this week is a recent announcement by Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese about a new emissions reduction target. The new national target looks to reduce emissions by 62 to 70% by 2035. This has infuriated many climate activists. They say it's nowhere near enough, and it's a disappointment for people like Jacinta Fa'amau, who were expecting a lot more from Albanese, who had made climate action promises during his re-election campaign. He was only re-elected a few months ago.
Disappointing. I mean, I could probably use a lot of other colourful words, but we're drawing the line at 1.5 degrees, and to reach that, Australia's NDC target had to be at least 70-75%. And I think yesterday, the day before, they announced it will be 62-70%, which is, a low blow for the Pacific, especially coming out of the Pacific Islands Forum, and then rolling out a new gas project that will go on to 2070. You know, Australia says they're like a part of the Pacific family, a part of the neighborhood, but then they turn their backs and continue to expand the fossil fuel industry, which will, you know, increase our global temperatures beyond 1.5, which is a dangerous level for our communities in the Pacific.
And that was Jacinta Fa'amau, a campaign specialist for Climate Action Group 350.org. And the reporter there was Pacific Beat's Finau Fonua. Australia has formally recognized Palestine as a sovereign state, becoming one of more than 150 countries to do so. The move was previewed in August, but became official yesterday in a joint statement by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Foreign Minister Penny Wong. Canada and the United Kingdom also made formal announcements recognizing a Palestine state, and about seven other Western countries have signaled they're about to do the same. Speaking in New York, where he's attending the United Nations General Assembly, Mr. Albanese says recognition is important for the futures of both Israel and Palestine.
Australians want the people of Palestine and the people of Israel to know a future of greater hope, true security, and real peace. Today we advance that cause. Tomorrow we continue that work.
That's Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Meanwhile, the Fiji government has been accused of abandoning its human rights principles over the opening of a new embassy in Jerusalem. The Fiji Human Rights NGO Coalition called the embassy opening shameful. But over the weekend, Prime Minister Stephen Rambuka took to social media in response to a Fiji Times caption.
It's very sad to see that the what used to be the major newspaper in Fiji, the Fiji Times, and its very senior editorial staff, putting on a caption of Prime Minister Netanyahu and I when we met, coup leader meets a war criminal. It is very, very irresponsible. That Fiji Times does not only circulate in Fiji, it circulates the world over. And for a paper that has enjoyed the respect of many other newspapers and media in the world, to stoop that low is unbecoming of the major newspaper of an emerging power in the Pacific.
And that was Fiji Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka responding to criticism about his recent trip to Israel, where Fiji opened up a new embassy in Jerusalem.
Pacific Beat.
Yes, you are listening to Pacific Beat on this Monday morning. I'm Evan Wasuka, standing in for Agnes Tupou, who just recently returned from a week-long broadcast of Pacific Beat out of Port Moresby, where PNG marked its 50th anniversary last week.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We stay in Papua New Guinea and we go to the autonomous region of Bougainville, where vote counting has been underway for the past week. Counting was initially scheduled to end today with the return of writs, but over the weekend, Bougainville's electoral commissioner announced an extension to the ballot count. That extension means voters will now have to wait a further 2 weeks to hear who will represent them. Joining me this morning for the latest news from Bougainville is Aloysius Laukai from Bougainville's New Dawn FM. Good morning, Aloysius.
Morning, Peter.
Aloysius, can you tell us why the Electoral Commissioner is delaying the return of writs?
The extension was made because counting hasn't finished yet, and they anticipate to finish by Wednesday this week.
Did he explain why there's been a delay in counting and why there needs to be an extension for the return of writs?
Yeah, he said because it was getting, you know, late for the counting to be completed. So it gave the extension so that they can complete the counting by this week. And they've extended to the 6th of October to return the writs.
Now, Aloysius, you, as the head of Bougainville's New Dawn FM, you've been covering the counting process that's been going on over the past week. How has that been, from what you observed, how has it been going?
It's been going peacefully, no problem throughout. We've been covering from, and we are still covering. We have reporters in the counting centers in Bouin in South Bougainville, and Arawa, Central Bougainville, and in Buka, where we are covering the presidential seat. The counting is very, very quiet, and people are just peacefully waiting for the result to be made. And we are bringing the result straight to the doorstep.
It's good to hear that everything is going along peacefully. What's the latest in terms of the vote count? Is there anything you can share with us this morning?
So far, out of 45 seats, including the president's seat, 27 seats have been declared, 12 in South Bougainville, 8 in North, and in Central, 7 seats have been declared.
Now, there's a lot of attention on the presidential vote. Is there much information coming out about what's happening with the presidential vote?
Yeah. Everything is transparent. Everybody's there. We've got monitors. We've got reporters. And we are covering it 24/7. And the result is, you know, a big difference in the margin. The current sitting member, the current president, is leading by, this morning he was on 70,000, and those who are coming second are on 10 and 20,000 only.
That's an interesting one to see and to hear that Ismail Tarama, the sitting president, has quite a large lead in terms of the president's vote count. When do we expect that part of the election, the president's vote count, to be completed by?
The primary count should be completed by today. And a total of, according to the electoral commissioner, about 238,000 voted. So the primary count should be around that.
Well, that's good to hear, and we'll certainly keep an ear out. Look, I'm interested to know what have the public been saying about the vote counting and the election itself?
The public have been quiet, and they're just monitoring what's happening. And they want the election count to be completed so that the next government can be formed.
Mm.
So because it's been extended to the 6th, so it's about 1 week after 6th, the official inauguration of the 5th House of Parliament.
Now, Aloysius, you mentioned there about the next government. Why is this election so important in terms of the future of Bougainville and its path towards independence?
You know, the referendum in 2019, people voted 97.7%. And it really excited the people to want the island to succeed from PNG. That's why people are motivated to make sure that all of them vote to get in the leaders they want to continue dialogue with the national government of Papua New Guinea.
Aloysius, thank you very much for keeping us across all the latest out of Bougainville's election vote count.
No problem. Thanks for nice to talk to you.
And that was Aloysius Laukai. He is the head of Bougainville's New Dawn FM, and he's keeping us up to date with all the happenings coming out of the election and the vote counting out of Bougainville. As we heard earlier in the program, world leaders will be delivering their emission targets to the United Nations this week. Australia is pledging a reduction of between 62 to 70% emissions on 2005 levels. But this has been criticized by Vanuatu for not being ambitious enough. Pacific Beach's Jordan Fennell put those criticisms to Australia's Minister for Pacific Islands Affairs, Pat Conroy.
Australia's 2035 target is ambitious but achievable, and most importantly, it respects and responds to the science. It accepts the recommendation from the Climate Change Authority that said that 62 to 70% is our highest possible ambition, and it also reflects what the IPCC said in their reports around what are contributions consistent with restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees.
Talking about it being ambitious, the UK has committed to 81% emissions reductions targets based on 1990 levels. In relation to that, is it really that ambitious if there are other countries pledging much higher?
Well, I'm only aware of two countries that have a higher target. I'm happy to be corrected. It's consistent with the range that Europe is consulting on right now. It's more than Canada, which is a sort of an economy comparable to Australia, and it's in line with what the COP host Brazil has actually agreed to. So I think this is certainly ambitious by global standards, and it responds to the science. So I think that's a reasonable position to take.
Earlier this month, the government agreed to expand the Northwest Shelf Gas Project, Australia's largest oil and gas project. Vanuatu's climate change minister has aired his concerns about that as well. Now, with these climate targets, while the framing is, of course, achievable but ambitious, to some it is lower than expected. Has Australia's government chosen coal and gas profits over the Pacific's climate security concerns?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. This target is in line with the science. It's in line with the advice given to us from the Climate Change Authority, and it's consistent with what the IPCC has recommended. So this is scientifically rigorous, and it reflects our strong commitment to taking action on climate change and playing our part, particularly acknowledging that the Pacific is on the front line of climate change. the decision around the Northwest Shelf is covered by the safeguards mechanism, which obliges that operation to meet reduction in emissions requirements under the safeguards mechanism as part of us reaching net zero emissions. So it's covered by the safeguards mechanism, which is one of the main mechanisms to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from our industrial sector, and that will continue going forward.
These climate targets are, of course, coming ahead of the UN's General Assembly, where Pacific Island nations are again going to push for stronger global action, especially on loss and damage finance. Will Australia be backing that call from the Pacific? And if so, what exactly will Australia be advocating for while in New York this year?
Well, I represented Australia at the Sharm el-Sheikh COP in Egypt, where the loss and damage fund concept was established, and we played a really positive role there, supporting and amplifying the Pacific voice to make sure that that happened. So, of course, we'll continue to play a constructive role in those processes. We're also the foundation and largest funder of the Pacific Resilience Fund, which is a critical fund to support resilience in the Pacific, particularly supporting small scale adaptation and mitigation projects in the Pacific. So we've been strong on climate finance, and we'll continue to do so. We'll also continue to amplify and support the voice of Pacific nations in these debates.
The UNGA will also focus on implementing the Paris Agreement ahead of COP31, which Australia is bidding to co-host with the Pacific. With these climate targets you've released, is there any concern that Turkey might have more ambitious targets, and does that put the bid at risk for COP31 in jeopardy at all?
Well, they're two separate processes. It's important to preface it with that. And secondly, I'd make the point that I'm advised that Turkey has not released its 2035 target. And its previous target was reductions against business as usual rather than against a historical year date. So that's not criticising Turkey, but it's making the point that our targets are ambitious, but they are separate processes, and that's really important. We are really committed to striving for and hosting a COP with the Pacific and shining a light on the Pacific experience of climate change. I think I'm one of the few international ministers to visit Tuvalu. I've certainly made 34 trips to the Pacific, and I can see the impact of climate change on every one of those visits. And it's very important that the world plays a role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, restricting it as much as possible, and supporting countries, particularly in the Pacific, who've done nothing to cause this problem, but are bearing the brunt of it.
Beyond climate, Pacific leaders have also raised security, oceans governance, and sustainable development as all being interconnected, of course, with climate issues. What role is Australia going to play at the UNGA in elevating Pacific voices on these broader climate-linked issues?
We will play a role of amplifying the voice of the Pacific. I remember one of my first international duties when I became the minister was to represent Australia at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. And I seconded a motion from the then Tuvalu Foreign Minister, Minister Kofi, to enrol the Commonwealth in arguing for changes to international maritime laws so that when an island is lost to climate change, that the exclusive economic zone isn't lost to that nation and the economic and cultural impact of that. So we've been committed to amplifying the voices of the Pacific, not just on climate change, but other things related to that, including development, where the biggest development partner of the Pacific in terms of ODA, and we're proud and privileged to have that role. And we're also very strong in encouraging the multilateral organisations, particularly the multilateral development banks, to do more in the Pacific and to reform how they operate and invest more in the Pacific and making sure that they use Pacific workers and Pacific companies as much as possible. I had a meeting with the president of the Asian Development Bank while I was in PNG, where we obviously discussed the importance of the ADB in supporting the Pacific. So you can expect Australia to be a strong and forthright voice for the Pacific in all these international fora.
That was Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, speaking there to the ABC's Jordan Fennell. And we take a look back at our top stories so far on Pacific Beat. Bougainville's Electoral Commissioner has announced an extension to the return of writs as there's more time needed for the counting of ballots. October the 6th is the new deadline. And as we heard earlier in the program, the sitting president, Ishmael Toroama, is leading the vote, the presidential vote. And world leaders are gathering in the American city of New York for the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly. There'll be a big focus on climate with the start of the climate summit, where countries will be presenting their updated emissions targets. Now, Australia has announced a 62 to 70% reduction on 2005 levels, but it's been labeled by activists as not ambitious enough. Stay tuned with Pacific Beat because we've got more stories coming up.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka with you on this Monday morning. And we turn to sports, where the Flying Fijians have won their third straight Pacific Nations Cup after defeating Japan 33-27 in Salt Lake City. Japan took an early 10-0 lead before Fiji came back strong just before the break to take the lead 26-10 into halftime. Winger Chochi Navoso scored Fiji's only try in the second half, but ill discipline nearly cost the Pacific Islanders the match. Two yellow cards against the Fijians allowed Japan to put up 17 unanswered points, and it pushed the game to the wire. But Fiji managed to hold the lead at full time. Flying Fijians captain Tevita Ikanivere praised the support from his players and officials in their winning campaign.
First of all, we'd like to give the all and honor and glory back to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. We are nothing without him, but through him we can do all things. Thank the coaches, thank the management for the great leadership. Thank the boys for coming out and doing the work. I think one of the biggest moments in that second half was when we turned the ball over here and then Caleb kicked a good 50-22. I think that was just great from him, and I think the momentum shifted from there, and Japan just couldn't come back from that.
For you as a skipper and as for your group, what does it mean to win this Pacific Nations Cup in 2024?
I think it's a big growth, young team. Surprised I was named skipper, but thank coaches for believing in me, and thank the boys for listening, and the bond in this group is just great. And we look on building onto this, onto November tour and towards the next World Cup.
I'll tell you what, sometimes a skipper armband can uplift players, and I think you've done that for you, outstanding both on and off the field. Congratulations, go and have a good time with the boys.
Thank you, sir.
And Flying Fijians coach Mick Burns, speaking after the final, said they were quite surprised by the speed of the Japanese team.
We just knew the first 20 minutes was going to be a real battle, and the speed that the Japanese side play with was going to be a challenge, and we just had to stay in there early. And I thought we worked really hard, set ourselves up for the second half by maintaining real good pressure in that first half.
I mean, the bench was always going to be integral, and it turned out to be that way for you guys tonight. When did you think tactically you were going to use that, or did you have a moment you already preconceived you're going to bring them on at a certain time?
No, I think just working through the way the game was unfolding, we just needed to make sure we could keep some fresh legs to come on. And I thought Ponte got two tries on debut, which was awesome. And then when Melly Tooney came on his debut as well, he hit the ruck really well and carried really well. So, you know, it was great to see the bench come on and do what we asked them to do.
It's an acquired taste, shall we say, but I'm sure you'll be amongst the carver tonight.
Look, I think first things first, just get around the boys and... we'll just congratulate them on a great 5 weeks. They've worked extremely hard. And I'd also like to thank the Japanese people for their tremendous hospitality. We haven't wanted for anything all week, and it's been tremendous. And so arigato gozaimashita.
That's Flying Fijians coach Mick Burns speaking there following Fiji's 33-27 win over Japan in the final of the Pacific Nations Cup. Meanwhile, Tonga claimed third spot in the competition after defeating Canada 35-24, also in Salt Lake City in the United States. When it comes to sport in Solomon Islands, cricket is not high on the list, and in recent years, it's all but disappeared. However, a revival has begun under the auspices of the Solomon Islands Cricket Federation. Originally from Sri Lanka, Federation President Sajiwalianage has plans for Solomons to become an associate member of the International Cricket Council as soon as next year. He concedes that persuading a soccer-crazy Solomon Islands to pick up a bat and ball won't be easy, but he says there are good reasons why previous attempts to promote cricket have failed.
There was no proper persons who drive cricket in Solomon Islands. Time to time, Australians, New Zealands and Sri Lankans were trying to develop this game among the communities, but it wasn't work properly. Because when I came to Solomons in 2012, most of the people who play cricket, they professional workers. So they complete their contracts and they went back to their own country. So there was no proper guidance who can manage and continue the game in Solomon Islands.
Therefore, I'm reading from that the task that you have set yourself is to develop an interest amongst Solomon Islanders. Is that what we're looking at here? You're trying to almost change the sporting culture.
Yeah, so our main focus to develop the game among the Solomon Islanders. We are trying to get support of them. Few Sri Lankans are there, few Australians are there, few New Zealands are there. They are helping, they are giving their experience, their support to our federation, especially the CEO, Miss Allison. She's from South Africa. She knows the game. She knows how important this game is for forming in Solomon Islands. So with all the support, our target is to develop this game with the Solomon Island people.
So when you look around the Pacific, and particularly at other Melanesian countries, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, both have very successful cricket programs, Fiji as well. I mean, I presume that's what you would like to emulate one day, but clearly it's going to take some time.
That's the main encourage for me to start cricket in Solomons, because like you said, Fiji, Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, Samoa, New Caledonia, all those countries are playing except Solomon Islands. So this is somewhat disappointment as a Solomon Islanders. So I thought if other countries can play, so we have a chance to play this game. Because cricket is highly developing in the world. 110 countries are members in the ICC at the moment. We have a plan to get our membership in 2026. We closely coordinate with the regional director how we progress cricket in Solomon Islands. What are our primary plans to reach our membership in 2026?
So if your membership is accepted, I read from that that you want to push on and try and establish representative teams as soon as possible. But I guess my question to you would be, is there sufficient talent in Solomon Islands that you've identified up to now to make that happen?
It's a real challenge. We are lack of actually the infrastructure. So with the support of governments, NSC and other few stakeholders and few sponsors helped us. So we have a focus. We have a courage. Hopefully next year we are going to have a proper structure in Solomon Islands, starting cricket in schools too. But when we started cricket, there are talent players. I can see the interest in the people.
In terms of facilities, I know that you have regular sessions at the Solomon Islands, the National Institute for Sport. But in terms of getting outdoors onto the cricket field, what facilities are available to you?
We use NSC facilities for our practice sessions. but we don't have a side wicket or a cement wicket to run a proper cricket game. So that's what we are discussing with the National Sport Council. And we had a meeting last month with the minister. So the minister wanted to develop all the games in Solomon Islands. So I hope they will help us, because it's a big challenge to have a turf wicket, but at least Astro wicket. Astro wicket we should have in the next couple of months to develop this game in Solomon Island. It's a challenge, yes.
Will that mean, though, that at least in the short term, in order to have regular matches, and I assume you would want to set up competitions, that they will have to be played on that one wicket in Honiara?
Yeah, so this year and next, we are planning to set up our games and our proper structures in Honiara. There is a full-time qualified coach from Sri Lanka. He will be arriving next month to Honiara. Then we have a plan to start cricket in schools. We already finalized 12 schools in Honiara. Next year, July, August, we are planning to spread into our regions too.
And you say you've set the target of 2026 to try and obtain ICC associate membership. Hand on heart at this stage, when do you think we might see a Solomon Islands national side, be it men or women, take to the field?
We already formed the Solomon Islands men's national team. I have 26 members. They are really progressing at the moment. But the national women's team, basically girls are not playing a single game of cricket. So we have to start A to Z. The coach is coming for that target too, because he will be a national coach for the women's team.
That's Sajiwa Lenage, president of the Solomon Islands Cricket Federation, on the line there from Honiara, and he was speaking to the ABC's Richard Ewart. In January 2022, one of the world's biggest volcanic eruptions took place in Tonga. The eruption was so powerful that ash from the Hunga Tonga volcano reached 58 kilometers into the atmosphere. And on the ground, the eruption caused a massive tsunami that covered some villages. The power and the impact of the eruption, which was the most powerful in the past century, has been the subject of many studies. And over the past 50 days, A team of scientists have been at the eruption site, where they've been mapping the seafloor and researching the volcanic site. Joining us this morning from on board the research vessel, the investigator, is the expedition's chief scientist, Associate Professor Dr. Rebecca Carey from the University of Tasmania. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
Now, Rebecca, your team has been mapping the floor around Hunga Tonga. What's been the key findings of the mission so far?
Yes, so our team's been mapping and sampling the seafloor around Hunga Tonga in order to answer questions about the power of the eruption, what the seafloor looks like, and how the biological communities that live on the seafloor, they were originally devastated by that volcanic ash, how they're recovering 3 years after the event. One of the main findings is that there is still very little macroscopic life on the seafloor. So that encompasses the biological species that are that we can see with our eyes. And we're still not seeing their recovery. But the good news is that the microscopic fauna, the fauna that we can't see, we have to look with microscopes, they seem to be getting a small foothold on recovering from this event. And we think that's driven by the dynamic sediment that's moving on the seafloor. When we've run deep towed cameras on the seafloor at depths up to 2,000 metres, what we've observed is that this very fine volcanic sediment is actively being moved around the seafloor. And that's important because the species that live on the seafloor are being inundated and covered in ash, and that really limits their recovery.
I read it's been described as mud soup. Can you explain a bit about why that's been the term being used?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So we've been doing these deep-toe cameras and we've seen how the landscape is very dynamic and these very fine ash particles are moving actively on the seafloor. We've sampled that ash with some of the equipment that's on the RV Investigator, the Australian research ship. And when we bring that material back onto the ship, it's like a mud soup. It's got a fluidity that is a little bit more than water. And that's just telling us that what the consistency of that seafloor is.
Now, Rebecca, I read that when the volcano erupted, it was described as having the power of 1,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. Was there anything able to survive that effect of that eruption?
So 3 months after the eruption, a New Zealand research group surveyed the seafloor, and they were able to demonstrate that to within about 80 kilometres away from Hunga, the biological communities were absolutely devastated. And 3 years later, we've seen the same thing with very little recovery.
Right. Now, Rebecca, I understand that tomorrow your team wraps up its expedition, but I want to take you back to when you first got a close look on the seafloor and the site of the eruption 3 years on after. What was your impression when you arrived there and you saw the site?
So we've been able to collect maps of the region around Hunga. So before the eruption in 2016, 3 months after the eruption in 2022, and this map of the eruption of the seafloor in 2025. And what we've recognised is that this landscape is really dynamic. We've got evidence that there's mass movement of sediment on the seafloor. And some of that mass movement of the seafloor has impacted the biological communities. But we also believe that this mass movement of the seafloor has also impacted the disruption or the breakage of the domestic communications cable that connects all the islands of Tonga. And that happened in 2024.
Right. This is Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka, and on the line with me from the research vessel investigator is Associate Professor Rebecca Carey. We're talking about her research expedition, which is happening right now in Tonga. Now, Rebecca, is the danger over? I understand that there's still a threat of localized tsunami due to weakened sea structure. Can you walk us through that bit of finding?
Sure. So very close to Hunga, there's up to 40 metres of this volcanic ash that's on the seafloor. And as we move more away from Hunga, up to about 100 kilometres away from the source volcano, that thickness is still up to a metre. Now, the landscape around here is very... It's like a volcanic landscape on land. You've got these huge volcanoes and these basins surrounding the volcanoes. And so these accumulations of volcanic ash will be susceptible to mass movement. What we've seen is that movement is very slow, but potentially with large earthquakes, the mass movement of that sediment could be quite significant that would trigger tsunamis. And so part of our work is to understand where that sediment is on steep slopes, and that will help inform Tonga Geological Services to do some hazard planning and mapping to understand that future risk.
Now, you mentioned that Tonga Geological Services. I understand your team is made up of scientists from different countries. Why is it important to have that multinational crew as part of this expedition?
Our expedition is quite varied in terms of the science that we're trying to investigate. So anything from the geology and the volcanology, why was this eruption so powerful, to the biology, how these biological communities are recovering. But we've also got a Tongan Geological Services chief geologist on board, Mele Manu. And Mele has just been so amazing in helping us to understand the context of this volcano and the eruption, and also to interpret what we see in the topographical maps of the seafloor, and also help us to, in the future, to communicate all our findings to the Tongan government.
Now, you're speaking from the CSIRO vessel, the investigator, which I understand is a fully kitted vessel with all the new technology. Can you talk me through some of the high-tech equipment your team has been using over the past 50 days or so?
Yes, yep. So on the Investigator, we've got what's called a multi-beam or multiple multi-beam systems, and that enables us to make a topographical map of the seafloor with 5 meter scale resolution, which essentially means that any feature that's 5 meters or larger on the seafloor, we can image with these sensors. And that's been really important to understand how the seafloor is changing over the time steps that we've got these maps. We've also got a lot of instruments on the Investigator. So we've got this deep-towed camera that can be flown about a meter to 2 meters above the seafloor. And at that depth, we're able to observe all of the biological species that are on the seafloor. We've also got a whole host of instruments to collect material from the seafloor. So that includes coring the sediment. So we get these 1 meter to 24 meter long pores, and those cores of sediment help us give us a sort of a vertical time series that helps us to understand the seafloor transport processes of the ash. And we've also got a dredge to collect some rocks and a sled which collects some of these biological species on the seafloor. And we're interested in collecting those because eventually they'll have their DNA sequenced, and that'll help us to understand whether these biological species are recovering, whether they're related to local species that are endemic to the Tonga region, or whether these biological species are actually invaders and they've come from much greater distance.
Rebecca, that's really fascinating to hear. Now, we have about 30 seconds left on the show. I wonder if you could just sum up your key moment from the expedition, which I understand wraps up pretty soon.
The key moment for me has been getting to the Hunga volcano on the Investigator and completing the first multi-beam map of the seafloor. And just based on that map, we're able to identify the change that has occurred over the last 3 years. And that was a really amazing starting point for us to therefore plan all the subsequent operations and to do that as a team so that we're getting the best value out of our use of the RV Investigator.
Rebecca, it's been fascinating talking to you this morning. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that was Associate Professor Rebecca Carey, and she's part of that research expedition looking at the Hunga Tonga volcano site. And that's pretty much it for Pacific Beat for this Monday morning. I'm Evan Wasuka, sitting in for Agnes Tupou, who's on leave. She'll
Thank
be
you.
Back on Wednesday. And that's it for our show for this morning. Join us at 5 o'clock Papua New Guinea time, where Richard Ewitt will be updating us on the latest. Apart from that, I'll be back on Pacific Beat tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Papua New Guinea time.